history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories by the people who live around you that we need to hear. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We meet some interesting characters, and we're educated, we're entertained, and oftentimes inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, we're going to meet a 93-year-old who was part of something top secret during World War II. These days, you can find him on the dance floor. How good a dancer are you, Bob?
I've been considered by some professionals as looking like a professional. Being very modest, let's put it this way. I just love to dance. I don't care how good I am as long as my partner's happy.
Good answer. Good answer. You can tell we're in for a fun ride today with Bob Allenby, 93 years old, of Newman, California. Now, I know where Newman is because I grew up in Los Banos, about 30 miles away. But tell the rest of our listeners, where in the world is Newman, California?
That's what everybody asks me. And sometimes I get confused. But if you go up I-5, turn off on 33 at Santanella, and go 10 miles... you will be in Gustine, and then go another 4 miles, and you'll be in that huge metropolis of Newman, all 5,215 of us.
Wow, he even knows the population. That's impressive. But originally, you're from somewhere further north of that, Ukiah, California. So growing up there in the 1930s, what was life like as a boy in Ukiah?
Well, I'll put it this way. We lived on a farm north of Ukiah, California. And this was in the 30s. And life was simple, isolated, and we always had, of course, this was during the Depression, we never went without butter, milk, all kinds of vegetables. We had our own chickens, we had our own pigs, we had bacon and eggs and ham. We raised corn to sell, Blue Lake string beans, and we raised pears. And because the life was so boring in Ukiah, California, for a 13-year-old, I requested to live in San Bruno, California, with my mother, who then moved to Palo Alto, California. Big life change, believe me.
Well, yeah, so you end up going to Palo Alto High School, which some folks may know is right across the street, literally, from Stanford University. That must have been an interesting place to be.
Well, I have to be perfectly frank. And I say this to encourage people that might be in the same situation I was. I came from a little town high school, freshman, to Palo Alto College Prep High School across the street from Stanford University. I felt lost. Quit school, went to work for the Western Union, met my future wife, who was 13, and I was 15. And that's how my life started to where I am now.
Wow. And who knew the twists and turns it was going to take in the years right ahead of that? I like to ask every veteran this question because everybody seems to remember. But December 7th, 1941, do you remember how you found out what happened that day?
I certainly do, because my future wife and I were together in Palo Alto, and we heard it on the radio and couldn't believe it. And then we believed it because, ladies and gentlemen, every light on the peninsula went out at our first air raid alert.
And a lot of people don't realize that. We're so used to the way things are now. But you're talking about the San Francisco area, the entire Bay Area. There's an air raid siren, and you have to turn out the lights and hope you're not getting bombed.
That's it. Between San Francisco and San Jose in those days, each town was separated by apricot orchards and cherry orchards and things of that sort. Every city had an air raid siren, which was the fire department. And I don't know, and all the headlights on cars were then became slits, and that's the only way you could drive at night. And these air raid sirens went off time after time after time because we were constantly on alert because nobody knew what the Japanese had in mind, and we did not know whether they were off the coast of California ready to invade the continental United States. It was fear everywhere because of the unknown, and as a teenager, redirected my life instantly.
How did that happen? How long did you wait before you entered the military?
This happened in 1941, and I joined in 1942 when I was 18 years old. And I joined in San Francisco, California. Of course, this changed my life forever. And I would like to say this to young people. I had a minimal education, but throughout my years in the United States Navy, I received an incredible education in many fields. Every young person should consider the possibilities.
And I've talked to a lot of guys who are getting ready to go over and had to make a decision. Well, do I ask my girlfriend to marry me now, or do I wait to make sure I come back? And you had that decision to make too, I guess.
Well, that's interesting because I went to boot camp in Farragut, Idaho. And then when I graduated from that, I went to Norman, Oklahoma, to Aircraft Mechanics School. After I graduated from there, I had my first leave and went to Menlo Park, California, where my girlfriend, my future wife, was living. 4 days before I was to return, we were walking down Mill Street in Menlo Park, and my wife, my future wife, Virginia, said, "Honey, let's get married." Well, the shock, I still can't believe. Anyway, we only had 4 days in Belize. This is wartime. We had to get our license over in Alameda, California. You had to go through physical tests at that time in order to get a license. We got our license the day before I was to return in Alameda. I was married at the Naval Air Station Chapel, Alameda, California, at 7 o'clock, July the 29th, 1943. That's how it all started.
And did you have an idea of what you were going to be doing in the Navy?
I really didn't, and this is one of the things about wartime. You never know what's coming up next. And I was transferred when I went back to Norman, Oklahoma, to this most secret squadron in Clinton, Oklahoma, a very, very isolated small town in a panhandle of Oklahoma. And it was a squadron that was experimenting with radio-controlled drones. And we used NBCs as our motherships and SNJs as our drones with pilots in it. This is where my future was determined. The first time I took a flight in the air, I decided I had to be an air crewman or had to be in the air. And because of lack of education, I couldn't be a pilot, but I could sure be an air crewman.
Because to this point, you're a mechanic?
Yes, I was graduated from aircraft mechanic school, so I was an aircraft mechanic.
But you get that first taste of flying. What were you in? What was the plane you were in?
The plane I was in was an SNJ, and that was a Navy trainer plane at the time. It was a drone at that time, where we used to fly about 50 feet off the ground, and the mothership, the SNB, would control us. And it was rather hazardous. We lost a couple of them due to malfunctions.
Well, yeah, people, I think, are scratching their heads right now. They're saying, drones? Aren't those little things kids are flying around with cameras in them? Because this is the 1940s you're talking about. And most people listening, I'm sure, don't even realize that radio-controlled technology was around then, that you could even do this. But you're out there risking your life for it, is what you're telling me.
Absolutely. You have to remember that in those days, radio-controlled was not electronic as much as it was hydraulic. They had a signal go from the mother plane to the drone, but the controls were all hydraulically operated, which means they were very rough. Now, I lost my best friend due to an accident. He was riding in the drone. But the drones that went overseas and did the work for us later on had two like homing engines, carried a torpedo, and where mothership was then a B-24 and controlled it for miles and miles away, and it worked beautifully, and they never lost the man in the Pacific.
Well, because they learned how not to in the training days in Oklahoma that you're telling us about, and I'm trying to make this add up here. On one hand, you're telling me that you were a guinea pig in a plane that you didn't have control of, but somebody in another plane did. You're completely at their mercy. And on the other hand, you're telling me it was so much fun, you had to keep flying. So which is it? Were you about to die or having the time of your life?
Well, you have to understand this is a wonderful thing about being young. You know darn well you're indestructible. Nothing's ever going to happen to you. Yes, we took our lives in our hands every time we got in that drone because we were only about 50 feet off the ground flying along Oklahoma. And like they say, we lost planes. But I never thought about that, and nobody else did. And that's one reason mostly young people go to war, because they feel nothing's ever going to happen to them. They are going to be the exception to the rule.
And what were you guys doing inside the drone? Why was it necessary for you to be in there?
Well, it was necessary, not as a passenger, because I rode as a passenger, but it was necessary to have a pilot in it, because if there was an error, he could help control and save the plane from crashing. The radio control planes in those days, being hydraulic, everything fluttered. It was not smooth, so all the controls were fluttering back and forth. It was a rough ride. If they pushed the control on the mothership and things malfunctioned, the pilot had to be quick enough to save that plane. And they did 99% of the time, but not every time.
So what happened with your friend, and how did you process that at the time?
Well, I only heard about it after it happened, and the plane crashed in the prairies out there in Oklahoma. And to this day, the only thing I have to remind me of it is I have a piece of his burned parachute, because both he and the pilot were killed. The plane caught fire, of course. That's when we woke up to the fact that, yes, we're all vulnerable, but it didn't scare us enough to keep us out of the plane. Let's face it, I'm indestructible.
Yeah, but on the other hand, there's 406,000 Americans who died in World War II, and when we talk about that, we think they died in North Africa or Italy or France or Germany or Japan or, you know, the Pacific Islands. We don't think about Oklahoma, but there were a lot of servicemen who died before they ever went overseas.
A lot of people don't realize how many Americans were lost during the World War II due to accidents. In fact, they had a greater loss of accidents in the air than they did from combat due to accidents. But that's one thing about air crewmen. Anybody that served in the air in any service was paid a higher rate of pay than any other because of the extra hazard of it.
You told us about these drones and working with them in the testing process, but can you explain to us the idea behind it, how the drone was supposed to work in a combat situation?
Yes, the whole idea was to save lives. If you will think about it, the biggest loss of lives in the air in the Navy was SBD torpedo bombers, dive bombers, TBMs, and in one attack, the first attack that the Americans made on Japanese aircraft carriers with TBMs and SBDs, every single pilot was lost except one. And the whole idea of the drone was to send a pilotless, manless instrument of destruction to the enemy that could not be shot down as easily as a manned airplane. Lower, faster, more destructive. And that was the whole idea, to save lives.
And when we hear about drones today, and drones are becoming a much more prominent element of our armed forces, and we have pilots sitting around America right now who are controlling drones all over the world, and those drones will go in and take somebody out and fly back. But you're talking about a drone that's on a one-way mission, right?
Yes. In fact, there's a news article, and they used to call it American kamikaze pilots. And the difference is our kamikaze planes were pilotless, and the man piloting that kamikaze plane, that drone, was 50 miles away at 20 or 30,000 feet controlling this plane diving into a battleship. And in Europe, they used it to fly into the submarine pens, and that's the way they destroyed them, but flying into the same way with over in Japan, sinking the ships. So there were no personnel involved.
How did they aim, and how did they hit their target?
They aimed strictly by visual. We had radar in those days, very crude, but we could use radar to see an object flying, and the mothership would use visual as well as radar to guide the drone into the enemy's target. The thing you have to remember, in those days, we could not go up and down and backwards and sideways. It was all forward. They had two Lycoming engines. They would travel a couple hundred miles an hour, and they were a regular size plane. And of course, they're very destructive because they carried torpedoes and huge bombs.
Now, when you said 50 miles away, I'm assuming, well, they can't see where that drone is hitting the target.
But they had to do something that far away, it would be strictly by radar. But yeah, 9 out of 10 times, they could do it visually, because by the time the drones became operative in the Pacific, we were pretty much in control of the air, and we could fly very closely to the enemy without danger.
But the idea was to crash this explosive-laden plane into an enemy ship or position.
Exactly. The whole thing was just like the kamikaze pilots the Japanese used. They crashed the plane into the target. That was the way that we destroyed many, many, many enemy ships and never lost a man in the Pacific.
And you can talk about it now, but back then, you couldn't even tell your wife, probably.
Nobody in the world except the people in Squadron 6 knew that this squadron existed until it was either 13 or 16 years after the war was over. The United States government never released any information that this squadron existed. That's how secret it was.
So let me ask you, have you ever been called a liar by telling people about this squadron because they didn't believe that it existed?
I really have told very, very few people about this squadron until right now, because I never found anybody that would understand what I was talking about. And until recently, not too many people are interested unless you're talking to the right person, which I am now, of course. But I never talked to anybody about it. This is the first time I've been able to explain it. I'm proud of it, although I wasn't part of it when it was over in the battle zone. I was part of it in Clinton, Oklahoma, and that's pride enough for me.
As well you should be. It's break time, but when we come back, we'll find out what Bob was doing in PBMs in the Pacific with VPB-20. We'll hear it in his 2017 voice, but also in his World War II voice, thanks to a recording the Navy made all those years ago.
Bob Allenby, aviation machinist, made third class, United States Navy.
Also, what was it like to fly through a typhoon, and which famous Hollywood star did he hitch a ride from on Okinawa? Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with 93-year-old Bob Allenby of Newman, California, originally from Ukiah in Northern California. He joined the Navy in 1942, and after some time in a secret squadron developing unmanned drone technology, he headed to the Pacific with VPB-20, a squadron in which he'd be flying aboard PBM Mariner seaplanes.
We headed to the Pacific from Banana River, Florida, which is Cape Canaveral now. We flew to San Diego. We flew to Alameda for some gunnery training. Flew to Kaneohe Bay in Hawaii, and then flew over to the South Pacific to an island called Tawi Tawi. And then we started our patrols. And for a country boy, it's absolutely mind-boggling to see how primitive the world really is in areas like the South Pacific, Borneo, Tawi Tawi, the Philippine Islands. The war aside, seeing the submerged atolls, huge 20-foot sharks, turtles, 4 or 5 feet feet in diameter swimming around in this water that you can see 100 feet below the surface. And when you're looking for submarines or enemy ships or enemy whatever, you see all this stuff because our patrols would last from 8 to 13 hours, and we would be flying 500 to 1,000 feet off the water, and we could see every single thing. And I'm still amazed to this day, something a lot of people didn't realize back in those days. We realized there were still cannibals in the world, and I was exposed to that very closely.
Well, I can't let you get away with saying that without some more explanation. Where and what did you see?
This is, a tragic and interesting story, but one of our planes was shot down, and the plane went down to the ocean. And the only reason I knew about it at the time was that one of my friends came aboard the ship that they rescued. His right arm was gone except for the bone. A shark had attacked him. Well, we sent out a crew to find the rest of the crew. These are 11-man crews on our planes.
Which is a PBM.
Which is a PBM-5 at that time, yes. Mm-hmm. And they went into Borneo. They knew where they went ashore. They saw where they went, and the thing they ran into, first of all, was this village of natives, which they discovered were cannibals. No, they never saw anybody. Never heard, no. We knew differently. I wasn't there, but our crew knew differently because the telltale signs were there that these crewmen had been there. They never did find them. Tragic story that you never hear about World War II.
And you mentioned 11-man crew. So explain to us your role on that crew.
Well, I was a flight engineer, and my job was to make sure that everything was mechanically okay for flight and to troubleshoot problems. And the plane was a very, very excellent aircraft. It had huge, huge fuel tanks. We had 36 different combinations that we could run on our control panel. And in all my years of flying, engine-wise, we never had a problem with that plane. And we flew, like I say, from Banana River, Florida to Okinawa and back to Guam. And we also went through an incredible experience flying from Guam to Okinawa. We flew through a typhoon that was so powerful we couldn't fly more than 100 feet off the water, which was foam, nothing but foam. And the wind was so turbulent, the plane was almost out of control. We lost a cowling off of one of our engines, but the plane got us there. So it was pretty strong.
What are you doing inside that plane when that's going on outside the plane? Are you sweating bullets? Are you thinking this is it? Never going to see the wife again? What are you thinking?
We really felt we were never going to make it because we were sideways up and down, and we were just incredible. I was on the flight engineers panel, and my job was to make sure that everything was working, but it was beyond our control. It was controlled by Mother Nature, and we were victims of Mother Nature, and we have to hand it to the plane and our pilot for being able to control it and get us back to now. The irony of this story is we got back to Okinawa, where we were. 2 days later, we were in the bay where all these airplanes, there were 50 or 60 airplanes, PB4Ys, PBMs, everything you could think of, ships. The typhoon hit the bay we were in. They took us ashore before the winds hit. The following day, there was not one airplane left in that bay. They were totally destroyed by 160-mile-an-hour winds, this typhoon. We lost destroyers out at sea, cruisers, 100-foot waves, terrible tragedy. But the following day, my plane captain and I decided we wanted to find our plane and take some of our stuff off of it. And we were walking down the road, and this Jeep came along, stopped, picked us up. I sat in the front seat. I looked over, and I thought, I know that guy. It was Tyrone Power, who happened to be a captain in the Marine Corps. Tyrone Power on Okinawa picked us sailors up. Yeah, he was as good looking in that Jeep as he was on the movies. But we did find our plane and we rescued some things off of it, but it was destroyed.
So you got some of your belongings, or did you grab a little piece of the plane to take home?
We got our belongings, but we always we took some things that we knew we would have for memorabilia afterwards. What they did with the planes, I don't know, because shortly after that, the war was over with, the bomb was dropped, and we were over. And then we were sent back to Guam and Hawaii.
Now, I've seen some of your records, and there's commendations and citations in there, and three times you're awarded the Air Medal every five missions you flew. You got another Air Medal or the cluster in lieu of it. So what were those missions like? Are you looking for submarines? Are you looking for downed pilots? What were the majority of your missions like?
We weren't looking for submarines particularly because we knew there weren't too many in the area, but we were primarily looking for Japanese installations, aircraft hiding and boats hiding and things of that sort. One of the missions we flew by a village, and I saw something in the overhang from the ocean that looked like it shouldn't belong there. And we flew by a couple of times, and then we came back, and I was a starboard waist gunner, and I opened fire on them, and I'd come to find out there were some barges the Japanese had hidden under there, and we destroyed those. And things of that sort. We were looking for all kinds of things that they had left behind. Also have one other interesting story about one of our missions that we did. There were three Australian commandos that had been stationed on this island off of Borneo. And they were actually there for weeks or months. I don't know exactly how long. And their job was to spot Japanese ships and aircraft and report them to the Americans. It was a very isolated, dangerous life for diseases and things of that sort. Well, they had been there so long, they developed serious diseases, beriberi, things of that sort. And we were commissioned to go out and rescue them. And we went out and landed offshore. I pedaled in our boat, but we got them back aboard plane, and we took off and brought them back to our seaplane tender. And that was one of the most satisfying things I did that I can remember. These poor men were skin and bones from illnesses, but they were as hard and tough. I always admire the Australians at that point, being exposed to them. Those are the kind of things we did. We patrolled South China Sea all the way up to Okinawa, and on Okinawa we were patrolling, getting ready for the invasion before the bombs were dropped. And that was the scariest part because we knew that we were never going to get back if we had to invade Japan. But let's say it made a nervous wreck of all of us.
Well, and I want to come back to that, but something else just occurred to me. With me asking you all these questions about what you were doing in the Pacific, does it feel at all like deja vu? Has this happened before in your life?
No, this is the first time that I've had a chance to really go over all the things that I've been talking about today.
No, it's not. You did it on the radio during World War II. We've got hard proof of this.
Well, I know, but not to the extent. Not to the extent. I was interviewed on my plane off of Borneo down in Tawi Tawi. A reporter requested that I answer some questions. And I have the 78 RPM record that the Navy sent to my wife to prove to her that I was still out there kicking around. And I answered a lot of questions, a lot of them very similar to this. But you have to remember the difference. Everything in those days was secret. And I could only say things in generalities. I couldn't say specifics like I can today in this interview and become more detailed than I could at that time.
Well, let's do this. Let's listen to that recording, since you still have it, from way back when. And then we'll see what further details we need to pull out.
Speaking to you from somewhere in the Philippine Islands, where he's serving 7th Fleet Aircraft, here is the voice of a man from California. Give us your name, please.
Bob Allen, the aviation machinist, mate, 3rd Class, United States Navy.
And where is your home?
Menlo Park, California. Street address, 1309 Mill Street.
Now, how long have you been in the Navy, Bob?
3 years.
Tell us what you do out here in the Pacific.
I'm flying in a PBM Martin Mariner patrol squadron.
And what's the job of your squadron?
Our squadron is to keep gasoline and shipping from Japanese held China coast, Indochina, to their homeland.
I see. And what else do you do?
We fly Black Cat and Dumbo. Black Catting is we take off in the evening, fly 12 or 14 hour hops over the China coast and along Formosa and Indochina. Mm-hmm. Dumbo, we go out, follow strikes, raids, and invasions, picking up whatever pilots are down during the operation.
Well, that's good work. Where all have you been out here?
I've covered the Borneo invasion, Bruni Bay, Balikpapan, Tarakan, Tawi Tawi, China coast, and Formosa.
Well, Bob, from all that action, is there some particular mission you've had which stands out in your mind?
Yes, I believe the most important is one day we took off on a sub-search and convoy coverage. We went out about 5 hours from our base when we developed a fire in our plane. We had to land, and it was very rough that day. We pulled over to the Borneo coast about a mile off of Jap-Hell Island, sat our plane down. As soon as we were on the water, we went to work, manned our turrets, and fixed our discrepancy. During this time, the Japanese opened fire on our plane. We did our best to keep them off. They sent boats out. We repelled their attacks. During this time, we fixed our discrepancy and took off. We got back to our base without being hit.
Well, you were firing back at them, were you?
Yes, indeed.
Well, that's quite an experience. Are you in a pretty good squadron out here, Bob?
Yes, we have the best PBM squadron in the Pacific. We have 135,000 tons of shipping sunk, 60,000 tons damaged.
Well, that's a fine record indeed. Are there any other service people in your family?
Yes, my brother is in the United States Navy, stationed in California.
Well, that's fine. What did you do before the war?
I was a student at Palo Alto High School.
And when you get out of the Navy?
I plan on opening a business of my own.
Where will this be?
In Palo Alto, if possible.
Well, good luck. Well, Bob, this is an opportunity for you to send a personal message in your own voice back home to the folks.
Yes, I want to say hello to my mother, my sister and her husband, and my brother, and especially to my wife. And, darling, I'll be home very soon, and we can take that trip we've dreamed about for so long.
Thank you very much. You have just heard Robert Allenby, aviation machinist mate, 3rd class, United States Navy, from California, speaking to you from somewhere in the Philippine Islands where he serves 7th Fleet Aircraft. This has been a United States Navy recording.
Well, you sound a little different now, Bob. It's only been, what, 73 years since then?
Well, yeah, and I think maybe I'm getting a little bit hoarse because I've spent an awful lot of time talking, and I enjoy that when I'm with interesting people.
I think you sound great. I like that baritone.
Well, I said that because I was hoping that's what you'd answer me by. But
well, and so we heard a very young Bob Allenby saying hello to his family, his wife back home in California. And they actually heard that on the radio or not till they got the recording?
Yes, they actually heard that. And my wife received the record, the actual 78 record from the Navy. And but they heard it on the radio. And, of course, I didn't know it at the time because I was still over in the Pacific.
And you told us before we listened to that that in that interview all those years ago, you had to kind of downplay what you were doing because you couldn't say too much. So tell us the real story. You did hint at a little gun battle with the Japanese there. What's the story about that mission?
There was another one also on our first mission down there. We saw some Japanese coming down a river, Bardio, in a boat. There again, I was a starboard gunner, and I had a chance to fire at them. I didn't hit them at that time, and they ran into the jungle, and so we just prayed that area where they are, so we never knew whether we hit them or not. But anyway, we thought we were doing what we were sent out there to do, is to destroy the enemy. And then the firefight that we had on the island off of the Philippines.
Yeah, so what we heard on that recording was you guys, you're not in the air, right, when this is happening?
That was the time we were rescuing the Australians from Borneo. And because we were close to the island, we were on our plane in the open sea, they were firing at us. The Japanese were firing at us and you know, with their machine guns and so forth and so on, while we were trying to take the Australians off the island to get them aboard our plane. And then we took off, and fortunately, we were not hit. And I don't know how far away the Japanese were firing at us, but they were firing at us, and we took off and rescued them, and nobody was injured.
I mean, that makes it sound pretty straightforward and simple, but I bet it didn't feel that way when they're shooting at you, and you're hoping and praying that they don't get you before you can get off the surface.
There's an old saying that when you feel the hair on the back of your head, those are called, yes, I know what that feeling's like. But, you know, there's one thing that's different about it. When you're actually involved at that time, there was no fear. There was nothing except get these people, get out of here. We're not going to be hurt. We're going to do this and it's going to be a success. Then when you get back to your ship or your base, you are scared to death and trembling and shaking and looking for a glass of wine or a shot or something, or looking up to heaven to thank somebody. But yes, you're not afraid at the time. And any time we were involved in combat or danger, there was no fear. It's after it's over with that the fear sets in. And I think that's just human nature, thank God.
Well, we're not done yet with the close calls Bob experienced in the Pacific. When we come back, the discovery that he made just in the nick of time to help his PBM avoid what would have been a devastating plunge into the ocean. Check out the photos and video of Bob at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and what has been an eye-opening conversation today with 93-year-old Bob Allenby of Newman, California. He was a flight engineer and gunner on PBM seaplanes in the Pacific, and he thinks the world of the men with whom he served.
Well, I think one of the biggest things you notice when you're in these situations is the camaraderie of your mates, your fellow servicemen. There is so much support. There is so much help. There's so much willingness to put their lives on the line to protect yours without even thinking that. And I think this is the most exciting thing about being in the service, is the camaraderie and the devotion to each other that servicemen have and never, ever forget. And I want to say thank you to all my shipmates for allowing me to still be here and enjoying life.
Well said. And you've already blown a lot of people's minds by telling them that the U.S. had drones in World War II. Now, most people, if you said the U.S. had no jet technology in World War II, they'd say, yeah, that's a true statement. There were no jets flying anywhere. But there were jet-assisted takeoffs. And I've had PBM pilots tell me about this before. You had those JADO units on some of the planes you flew in?
Well, one of the things about the PBM is it replaced the PB-2I consolidated because it was a fragile airplane. The PBM was a big, tough plane designed to land in the open sea, which even in the calmest is very dangerous and destructive if it's not done correctly. When you rescue somebody at sea and you're in the open sea, like in Iwo Jima or Tarawa or wherever, and you have to take off, the shorter the runway of taking off, the less better chance you have of surviving or your plane not crashing, or what they call porpoising. They gave us what they call JADO, Jet Assisted Takeoff, and it was two jet assisted things attached to the port and starboard side of the waist of our plane. This could be activated when the pilot put his throttles forward and the plane got up on the plane. When you throttle, the plane dips to the back. And then when it gets on what they call the plane to break the suction on the water, they would activate the JADO and that plane would go instantly in the air at an incredible attitude, almost like a fighter plane. So it cut the takeoff by, maybe a half at least, and it made open sea takeoffs much safer for everybody concerned.
Did it feel like getting shot out of a cannon?
Believe me, it scared us the first time. Yes, it did. You hung on because it was like a jet. Instant. It wasn't one of these like you put the power on like a jet airplane. It was instant, slow, safe, instant 80 miles an hour to 150 before you could even say the word. Yes, very scary. And the one thing you had to think about was, and I've never been able to get an answer to this, what if one side failed and the other side worked? Would we be atop?
I think you'd be pretty dizzy. That's what you'd be, right?
I think that would have been it. But those things go through your mind with new things that you don't know what they're doing. You know, what's a jet? What's a jet? But, yes, there are always concerns. But believe me, there were many times we were glad we had it.
Are there times you look back on and say, you know, that was a really close call? That could have been it for me?
We had several of those. One time when our pilot, a seaplane, has one big problem in takeoffs. They have what they call porpoising, if it is not balanced correctly. And that is, it does exactly what a porpoise does. It goes up and down, and that becomes even more so until finally it nosedives right into the ocean, and it's happened to other planes, and you're lost. You're gone. One time we were flying on patrol, both engines absolutely quit instantly. Just quit. And I was on the flight deck, but I was talking to our navigator, and our plane captain was a flight engineer panel. He had a habit of drawing cartoons, and he wasn't paying attention to the instrument panel, and he let the fuel tank run dry. Well, I instantly went back and turned it to the right, and these engines caught. Oh, we were about 100 feet off the water. A little nerve-wracking, I'd say. Yes, that was one. We had that.
And so I want everybody to understand what happened here. So he had not switched to another fuel tank that still had something, let that one go dry. And if you hadn't figured that out and switched it, you probably had a few seconds and you guys are all dead.
We'd all been gone. We'd have crashed. Yeah, we would have had an uncontrolled landing. Absolutely. And, of course, the other time was flying through the typhoon. And the other time we made a dive that was kind of a close call, too, that was nerve-wracking. Our pilot made a dive on a village because we had a suspected gun emplacement there. And he let it go a little bit. This is a big plane, weighed 26 tons. And it's not like a fighter plane. So when he was diving on the town, he didn't pull up soon enough, and he hit some high trees. I don't know if they were palm trees or what, but anyway, he hit them, and we had quite a few branches stuck in the rear end of our plane, so we came pretty close to maybe joining these bad guys down there.
Yeah, and they wouldn't have been very happy with you. When you mentioned Japan's surrender after the deployment of the nuclear bombs, I said I wanted to come back to that. So you said that was a relief to you when the bombs were dropped and when Japan surrendered, because you thought if the invasion had happened, you might not have survived. Do you know what you guys would have been doing as part of that?
Well, yes, because we were already flying patrols up off the coast of Japan. We had pretty well controlled the Japanese Air Force, and we didn't have too much to worry about. But we had ground fire, and of course we had some planes, but we were making patrols looking for places to land troops, where their fortifications were, things of this sort. But anybody that knew the mentality of the Japanese military, not the Japanese people necessarily, but the military, they're fanatical, suicidal. Americans are not that way. We will do what we can with the minimum amount of life lost. So we knew if we were going to invade Japan, that most of us that started at the beginning would probably not survive. And any military man in the know would tell you now that's absolutely the truth. And that's why President Truman saved millions of American servicemen's lives and Japanese lives by dropping those two bombs. And when I hear people say it was a terrible thing to do because we killed so many civilians, let me remind people that those bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki did not kill nearly as many civilians as the bombs dropped on Germany, Dresden, and those cities in area bombings. War is war is war, and our country did what it had to do to save Japanese and American lives. Thank you, Truman.
Yeah, you're not the first veteran who shared those kind of sentiments with me. So after all that happened, you got to come back home. You got to see your wife again, become a father, move on with life. How exciting was that to get back to the U.S.?
Well, you know, it was very exciting because it was a big relief. Oh, I made it. I got back to the United States, and the Navy sent me to a special school in Chicago. The school was designed to make me an instructor for Top Gun fighter pilots at Camp Miramar, San Diego, California. Corsairs, F-7S, F-8Fs, Hellcats. In the meantime, they found out I wasn't going to make a career and re-enlist. I had enlisted in the regular Navy. They sent me to Hawaii. Terrible punishment. for my last year in the Navy, terrible duty, shore patrolman on Waikiki Beach in Hawaii, just with terrible suffering over there. And that's the way I spent my last year in the Navy, and I was discharged in September at the Alameda Naval Air Station in California, joined my wife with my two-year-old daughter, who cried and didn't want me to touch her because she didn't know who the heck I was. But yes, that's the way it ended, and it was not bad. We had one other exciting thing happen to us while we were off the coast of Japan making patrols. And the one reason that we had gone to Guam to pick up an airplane and come back and fly through the typhoon. We were a couple hours out or so, and I was walking down the walkway to the tail end just to see how things were going and make sure that everything was loaded, the ammunition, and I smelled raw gasoline. Well, our hull tank held 5,000 gallons of gasoline, and it was bulletproof, which means it wouldn't leak. But I took the cover off of the floor, and our hull was just solid gasoline floating around down there. Well, all you need to do, of course, this is back in the days when everybody smoked, and you smoked aboard a plane. All you had to do was light a match, and we would have been history. So immediately I ran up to the pilot and told him that we had a fuel leak. Well, he sent the co-pilot back to confirm what I said was right. And yes, the smoking lamp was out, and we flew back to Okinawa. That was a close call that we had a mechanical problem, and that's the reason we went back to Guam to pick up a new plane to continue our patrols.
I didn't ask you if you ever got yourself in any trouble in the Navy.
Yes.
You're an honest man.
Well, I've had so many people ask me. I was in the Navy for 6 years. How come you've got a third class and you've been in the Navy for 5 years? Well, sometimes it takes a little while to learn seriousness of discipline. When I made it on my first leave, when I was in gunnery school in Cecil Field, Florida, I had gone out to the gunnery range, and next thing I knew, I was in the hospital. I had passed out. Well, I had pneumonia. Anyway, I got over that. They were going to give me a leave to come home, and I got food poisoning, and I was in the hospital for another week, but they sent me home. And, of course, I hadn't been married. I'd only been with my wife for one day after we got married. So when I was home, and back in those days, I hitchhiked from Florida to California, so it took a few days to get there. So when I got there, I wired the base for an extension. Well, I didn't get an answer, and I thought, well, maybe I would. But anyway, I was about 3 days late getting back to Jacksonville, Florida, and I was met by some very nice Marines who put me in the chair, shaved my head, and threw me in the brig. I was sentenced to 10 days in the brig for absent over leave. When I was in Chicago, I wanted to go on Liberty. They had some great bands downtown, so I borrowed my best friend's Liberty card. Shore Patrol asked me for my pass. I had his pass. I was in the brig, and at that time I had been, it was second class. I had a captain's mass, and they broke me down to third, and that's why I wound up being third class. But the irony of it was, and that's why I'm smiling right now, even though you can't see me, my wife was pregnant. And as a second classman, I had to pay for the hospital bill. As a third classman, the Navy paid for it. Thank you, Captain.
Yeah, that is pretty ironic. Well, I don't want to forget this. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a pretty intriguing story as only you could. When you look back on your Navy days, is there something that you would say you're most proud of?
Yes, I am. I think I'm most proud of the men and women. There were waves back in those days, but the men and my fellow servicemen, it makes you throw your shoulders back and be proud to be an American. And I think the other thing I have to thank the Navy for, which I think made my life a lot easier, was the incredible education I got from the Navy. Their school, their special schoolings, the lesson of life under so many circumstances, so many people I met from various parts of the world, Okinawa, the jungles of Borneo and Tawi Tawi and the Philippine Islands and the United States itself. Yes, I am proud to say thank you, Navy. Thank you, America. I have been rewarded 1,000 times over for the experience of World War II and still being here talking to you. God bless America.
Amen to that. And I think you can give me a good answer to this. Not everybody can. Since there are so few World War II veterans left, and most of the people listening right now weren't alive during that time, what do you think we need to know and people need to remember on into the future about what happened in World War II, what you guys all did, and why you did it?
I think the one thing that most people don't think about, and every time you look at a World War II veteran or a veteran of any war, and particularly World War II, is there was a draft. I went in the service and spent 6 years of the most productive part of my life and put it on the line. And every other veteran, every other serviceman spent his teenage and young 20s protecting his country and protecting the world for the freedoms. But it's a sacrifice of the prime of your life that you can never recover. You're only 18 once, you're only 19 once, you're only 20 once, and you try to pick up. And the thing that's entered my mind more than anything I've thought of 1,000 times, and I know every veteran has, and still does, what would I have done and what would I have been if the war hadn't come along and I hadn't been in the service? I don't know. I am one of the lucky ones, very lucky. It's the people you see that are blind, without arms, in wheelchairs, that sacrificed the youth of their life, and they will never, ever be fully appreciated for what they have sacrificed. And I could cry thinking about it.
Well, maybe they'll be better appreciated because of those words you just shared. And I guess I have to throw another what if at you, if you're going to throw that one out there. Well, what if you didn't switch that fuel tank in time? What if that typhoon took you down? What if those Japanese bullets got you? You've got kids and grandkids that would have never been born.
Well, see, that's the thing. That's what I mean. You lose. If all of those things had happened, and it happened to so many, I'm one of the lucky ones. If fickle finger of fate had made our plane crash, had caught a fire, or crashed in the typhoon, yes, my first daughter, my second daughter would not be here. My wife would have been a widow. Who knows? And the odds are that there would always been this tragic thing in the back of anybody, my mother, my brother, my father. What happened to him? They would have never found us. It's the unknown that is a mind-boggling, tear-you-apart feeling that these people have for somebody that disappears. It is a tragedy that I don't have the vocabulary to describe what kind of a feeling that would have been for my loved ones.
Well, let's wrap up with this note. I know you said, and very, I thought, poignantly and powerfully, you shared how you and so many others gave up the prime of your life. But it seems to me, I don't know that much about you, but it seems to me like you're kind of recapturing that in your 90s, aren't you? Don't you go out dancing every weekend with a special somebody?
Yes, I do. And you know, one of the things I think, I don't know whether it affects everybody like it does me, did me, but it gave me an incredible appreciation of life. Don't waste on negative thoughts, on negative feelings. My wife and I enjoyed life to the fullest. I had a good job all my life. I am not a bit ashamed to say I don't have any money now, because my wife and I lived life to the fullest because we realized how incredibly priceless life is every minute you take a breath. I live that way today. I refuse to be negative about anything. I love to get up in the morning and watch the sunrise. I love to look at a smile on somebody's face. I love to see somebody holding hands. One of my favorite songs today is a song that Louis Armstrong sang years ago. And the important words of it is, I think to myself, what a wonderful world. And it is, if you look at it that way. Don't hate. There's too much love to be received and given. And I love love and dancing and music. And I have a very special person that helps me have fun in life, Joan Hagen.
Well, I think she's special too, because she's the one that ratted you out and told me I needed to come talk to you. Is there anything else you want to say?
I really am proud to have had the chance to express myself and talk about these things in the past. I still throw my shoulders back when I think about the service and the friends. I just am overwhelmed with pride that you give me the chance to express myself. I get it off my chest because it's been in my heart, my mind for years. And until something becomes rather rare and hard to find, which World War II veterans are getting to be now, the value and importance of it really isn't appreciated. And I want to say to my fellow veterans, World War II and others, God bless you. Keep a smile on your face. You're still here.
Well said. I didn't know it was going to get so philosophical and emotional today, but I'm glad it did. That is Bob Allenby, 93 years old, of Newman, California. Check out the photos of Bob then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And join us again next time when we'll be reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.